know you, don't know what I'm going through. Standing here looking at you, well, let me tell you that it's so bad. It makes me feel so sad. It's
going 64. Little Anthony and the Imperials, Hurt So Bad. Well, I know it's kind of a transition to our next guest, who came out with a wonderful book, and it was called Needless Suffering, How Society Fails Those with Chronic Pain. Just missed cracking the top of the New York Times bestseller list. With us, the author, Dr. David Nagel from Concord Orthopedics. Morning, David.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Living the dream, and you?
Yeah, pretty much. I'd say that. Yeah, I'm sitting in a parking lot at the hospital. This is wonderful.
Oh, David.
Make it better.
You didn't have to sit in a parking lot. Come on.
But it's the best place to talk to you. The feng shui is perfect here.
Okay, well, whatever. Well, look, let me, while you sit there, smoke them if you got them, have a coffee, whatever. Let me, by way of introduction to you, let me read something from the book, Needless Suffering, How Society Fails Those with Chronic Pain. Let me skip up to page 48. And the book says, and I quote, "The mystery of pain is a puzzle that has tormented humanity more than any other puzzle in medicine. It has baffled the medical world for centuries. Each generation mocks the one before, thinking it is closer to solving the riddle. But pain has many forms, and we're still far from understanding its varying nature. We don't understand the many neural pathways that convey pain information. We don't know how to describe each person's pain, and we don't have any way of predicting who will respond to what treatment. And since we lack this, since we see this lack of knowledge as a sign of weakness, doctors concoct theories rather than acknowledging their limitations. Then they pretend that their theories explain everything and that they are experts. The less we know, the more experts there are. In reality, like the blind men touching only part of an elephant and basing their conclusions on just that one part, each expert only understands a small piece of the whole. But in my opinion, the person who is willing to ask, what do we know and what don't we know, is the true expert. For you can only seek answers if you are willing to admit to yourself that you don't know them," unquote. That's pretty profound, David, and I'm assuming that was you writing and not a ghostwriter.
No, that was me.
No.
Yeah.
And I know some doctors must really hate you.
You know what's really funny? I hadn't heard that in a while. And as you're reading it, all I could think of was a couple of things that had happened somewhat recently. But you know, when you tell people reality, like I was talking at a meeting, there was a meeting of supposed experts on pain management. We were trying to chart the future of pain management in the United States, and we were supposed to go around the room and say what we thought were the problems, and because you don't find solutions till you acknowledge the problems. So I said what I thought, and you know, I thought people were going to throw tomatoes at me, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I said something along the lines of what you just read. And I was really amazed because the people that were in that room were really smart people, real experts, whatever. And they came up to me one by one after and said, "You're the only person that said anything smart at that room." And all I said is, "We just don't know, you know?" And but acknowledging limitations is really important, and I was kind of like shocked and amazed by that. But I work with the University of Rochester Pain Department, and the gentleman that runs that department, he said that we really need to understand what you just read, because we're not going anywhere, you know, by just lying to patients about what we can and we can't do.
So is that sentiment getting any traction, David, or are the experts still plodding along in their little expert realms?
Well, as long as expertise pays well, which it does, you're going to find a lot of reluctance. Because I've seen people say, you know, that's like really profound, and you know, it's kind of like Jesus walking around and telling us we need to love each other and say, yeah, that's a really great sentiment and a great idea. Let's do that. And the next day, turn around and beat the crap out of their neighbor. You know, it's kind of like that. People acknowledge it and then turn around and fall into the profitability realm and do what's profitable, not what's necessarily right. And, I mean, I think until we that is what I said at that meeting, that until we acknowledge that we're there for the needs of the individual, not for the needs of our bottom line, that we're always going to have problems.
Okay, now, David, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I've spent years on the marketing side, working in advertising and marketing, and uh-huh. I have been guided by one premise and one premise only. Every ad, every TV commercial, every president's letter, everything I do has to accomplish one of two things. I have to explain to the reader, to the listener, or to the viewer, what's in it for me, or how are you going to make my life better? If I don't address one of those two points, I basically have wasted the client's money. Okay, so now when I go to see the doctor, I want to know, how are you going to make my life better, or what's in it for me? I want the pain to go away. Right. I don't want it masked. I want the pain to go away. And that ain't happening.
Yeah. And that's what's the interesting thing about first and second world medicine is the expectations are a lot different than, say, in third world medicine. And I think even historically, if you looked at the United States years and years and years ago, that people accepted pain as part of life. And I'm not saying that you should do that. But what I'm saying is that our expectations exceed our abilities to resolve them. And I think you brought up from the very beginning differentiating between acute and chronic pain. You didn't kind of say that, but you applied it. You know, when you were giving my intro way back, but you know, what our abilities are to do with something that's acute versus chronic is very different. So like when you come into my office and you know, you tweaked your back yesterday or you hurt your shoulder throwing to your kid the other day or whatever. I mean, I think, you know, resolving that problem is certainly a realistic outcome, you know, but when you're dealing with what I'm talking about is something that's been going on for months or years or whatever, then the expectations really need to change. I do think the interaction needs to start out with, you know, a realistic assessment of, you know, outcomes, matching our agendas. Like, you know, what do you want out of this? What do I think I can give you out of this? And how do we go about getting that? What I've found with people with chronic pain is that it's very much like psychotherapy in the sense that it's a process. You don't just walk into my office and I expect you to buy into what I just said right away. It takes time and patience, and that gets us back to the profitability thing is that nobody wants to pay for that. And I'm not about the patient. I'm talking about the insurers. They don't want to pay, you know, me to do that. They're more than happy to pay for me to prescribe a pill for you that may or may not work, or they may pay for me to do a procedure that probably won't work or may give you some short-term benefit. And I think that's where the problems are, is that we need to change how we pay doctors to manage complex medical problems.
Look, I think in the book, Needless Suffering, you also made what I thought was another salient observation, that one of the biggest enemies that I have as a patient coming to see you is the computer, because the doctors are conditioned to the computer, and they're sitting, the computer's against the wall, the doctor's back is facing me, I'm sitting in a room going, hello, look at me over here, but they're on the computer because that tells me everything.
You know, you brought up such a neat thing, because in 1981, we had a debate in medical school about pro or con about computers and healthcare, and I willingly took the con point of view, and I, to this day, everything I said in that debate is true. I think that, you know, our primary responsibility to every patient is mediated through the doctor-patient relationship, which means that I sit down with you, I listen to you, you listen to me. There's no computer that sits in between us. And the minute you stick one in between us, I think it destroys that interaction. And one of my smart professors taught us that 90% of what I decide to do for you is based on what you tell me. So if I'm not hearing what you're telling me, but I'm hearing what the computer wants me to stick into some template, then I'm going to miss, you know, doing the best that I can for you. And I just think that, I think it's a real big problem. And I'm not the only one that's acknowledged this, but yeah, I mean, we're kind of forced by Medicare and meaningful use and all sorts of other major terms to feed information to a computer to help them out. And I think it's, and then we're told by, you know, corporate healthcare that we can only spend 5 to 10 minutes with you. So how do you find the balance between there and acknowledge what you can and you can't do? I'm in private practice. I can do what I want. Nobody tells me what I can and can't have in the room. I'm really lucky, but I'm one of 17% of doctors in the United States who practices in a private setting.
Wow.
When I started, it was flipped. It was about 81% of doctors were in private practice and had total control over how they manage their practice. I think it's a very dangerous flip. I don't think it's been good for healthcare at all. And certainly for complex disabilities like pain and other things that I deal with, it's a total negative.
Dr. David Nagel, Concord Orthopedics, on with us. David, let's assume somebody, as you said, a couple of generations ago, perhaps the greatest generation, if they had chronic pain, they just sucked it up and they lived with it. They just said, you know, hey, that's the price you pay for hanging around on this mortal coil for longer than somebody else. But for the people now who walk into the doctor's office, some doctors have this little scale. Okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, let's measure the pain. Is there any validity to trying to grade it that way?
There's two different responses for what you said, the greatest generation. And I mean, people have dealt with pain in a lot of adverse, crazy ways over the decades. But yeah, that's we like to think that people sucked it up. I don't really think they always did, but that's another story.
Okay.
As far as grading pain, I mean, people have used alcohol, opioids, cannabinoids, whatever, for centuries. It's not like those are new things. But as far as grading pain, I look at the whole person. I want to know who they are, what they do, you know, what gives them meaning in life, which is probably the most important thing I find out about the person, and how what their pain is, how it's interfering with their abilities to do what they really want to do, need to do, or whatever, and then how do we focus on adaptation. You cannot stuff that into a number. So in other words, an assessment is a discussion. It's not here, fill this out.
Okay.
With that said, do I ask people to do that? Well, most of the insurance companies require that I have some sort of number. So I do that. But I think it's really important to look at the story behind the number and how that'll fit into what we're doing.
All right. Now, you and I have had chats for quite a few years, and I know when we first talked, there was some legitimate concern that too many medical practitioners were cranking out prescriptions for opioids. Again, as you would point out to me, it wasn't solving the problem, it was masking the problem. So then the spotlight was turned on about opioid addiction in New Hampshire and blah, blah, blah. Has the resulting publicity caused doctors to reduce their cranking out scripts for opioids and perhaps asked questions instead of just throwing this and say, here, this will take care of it?
Well, I think it's really funny and weird in a way because, I mean, opioids do help some people, and that's the challenge in pain management is figuring out who they are and who they're not. The public policy measures that have been created have caused irreparable harm to those people, so that's a big problem. On the flip side of it, all I've seen is that all doctors are doing is, all right, well, I'm not going to give you an opioid. You can't have that, which isn't true. You can, but the same time, what they're doing is they're offering other drugs in its place. So now everybody wants to be on cannabis. And, you know, and people are failing to acknowledge the harm that that creates. Everybody's on gabapentin now, which, you know, it's not even a pain medicine, but you know, makes the doc feel good like he's done something, and you give it to an elderly woman who gets, you know, balance problem, falls and breaks her hip. I mean, it's kind of like, did I really accomplish something good here, you know? The challenge is, again, you know, is sitting down with people, getting to understand them, getting to know them. Does this person a reasonable candidate for an opioid? That was the big problem with the opioid crisis, wasn't that doctors were writing too many scripts. It was that they weren't really thinking about what they were doing. They were just writing it because they could, because we said it was okay. I mean, right from the very beginning, I was involved in the opioid discussion since 1987. And even back then, we were just saying, you know, these are potentially harmful drugs that are also potentially helpful. And you really need to sit down and think, does this make sense for this individual? Because by making that prescription, you're making a lifetime decision. And that should never be taken lightly. And that was the problem, was people started taking it too lightly. Are they writing less? Yeah. I think we have a crisis of both over and under prescription right now, which I probably thought was true before as well. It's just the metrics are different now than they were back then.
Do you ever,
but it's really... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead, David.
I just, you know, I work with a number of patient advocacy groups, and when you see people that have been on opioids for 20 years that were doing really well with it, and you see a doctor arbitrarily take him off of that drug and then functionally kill him. I've seen people killed by that behavior because they're under the belief that the governor or whomever says that they're not allowed to write that prescription, which is kind of weird. I mean, it's really hard because I've known a number of people that have been harmed by that. And they always tell me the same story. The doctor told me it was illegal for him to write this. And I said, no, it's not. Where did you get that from? You know, you need to follow rules, but it's not illegal to write for it.
Wow. Do you ever feel like Don Quixote tilting at windmills?
You know, it's sad. I don't know anything about Don Quixote. I'm sorry. I'm missing the analogy.
Well, that he was doing the trying to do the impossible. So he was just tilting at windmills and really wasn't getting anywhere. I mean, you've been this voice in the woods, you know, for years going, hello, you know what we need to do?
Yeah.
And people quietly will come up to you after a meeting and say, you know, David, you're right. But is it, are we getting anywhere?
That's a really interesting question. I would say no. I mean, I think that as a society, you know, we still look at patients with pain as a pariah. You know, anybody that doesn't respond to our treatments, we look at as, you know, somebody that's, you know, not worthy, or we look at as a problem with a personality issue as opposed to a real medical problem. And I think that I don't know. I really don't think that it's a huge amount better. And you're reminding my best friend, well, I've got a lot of good friends, but Myra Christopher, who wrote the foreword for my book, and she did so much work for advocacy for people with pain, primarily end-of-life pain initially, but then for chronic pain. And she told me exactly what you just said. She goes, I've been working at this for 2 decades, and I don't feel like I've gotten anywhere. And I'm not sure. I think our problem in healthcare is that we're focused so much on cure that we don't learn how to focus on management. You know, management of, like, you know, if you have a stroke, I can't make your weakness get better, but I can help you adapt to that. You know, that's why I went into physical medicine, because I really wasn't interested in curing complex problems. I was more interested in how do I help you have a better quality of life despite your problem. And that was because I grew up in a house where people were disabled. So, and I saw how my dad adapted my mom's life so that she could have a meaningful life. And I just thought that made more sense. And I think in pain, it's the same thing. The difference is in pain, you know, pain just nags at you. It's a horrible thing to have forever, but, you know, it is what it is, and you just do your best to help people have at least a meaningful quality of life despite it.
And you come by it honestly, because you've been suffering for years as a Buffalo Bills fan, so you know all about pain.
I was waiting for that.
You knew I was going to get there. Oh, no, come on. I think the Bills, Bills-Jets, Sunday, 4:25. Jets, you know, almost had Tom Brady. You do not give Tom Brady 2 minutes and down one score. You don't give them the ball with 2 minutes left. But I think the Bills over the Jets, and I'm going to go 34-24.
All right, that's fair. Okay. That's fair. I'm going to be there, but I'm not going to be one of the people with bare chested, I guarantee you. So,
are you wearing your Daryl LaMonica?
Yes, I will be wearing my Daryl LaMonica. Good luck, Buffalo Bills.
All right. I'll look for you on TV. For your birthday, I'm buying you a copy of Don Quixote. You're going to read the damn book, David.
There you go.
All right.
By the way, there's an article about Preston Riddle, Huber, who played for both the Bills and the Patriots. It was in the Buffalo News today. It's must reading because he's one of my favorite 1960s AFL stories. So if you got nothing better to do, Google Buffalo News and Preston Riddle, Huber.
You got it. All right. Have fun at the game, David. Stay well, my friend, and we'll do this again.
Yes, I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Stay well.
All right. You too.
From Concord Orthopedics, Dr. David Nagel. And again, pain management. And you heard him. I mean, David's realistic. He admits some doctors really aren't doing. So you have chronic pain? Talk to David. 852. We'll be back.